Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 11th, 2019. The time is 9:02 a.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, and Senator Wilikowski. We have a quorum to do business. We also have President Kathy Geisel joining us as well. On today's agenda, we have two bills in front of us. We have Senate Bill 4, naming Scott Johnson Memorial Bridge, and Senate Bill 12, assault, sex offenses, sentencing credit. All right. I'd like to direct members' attention to Senate Bill 4, naming Scott Johnson Memorial Bridge. On March 8th, we took the bill, took public testimony, and reviewed the fiscal note. My office received no amendments and heard no concerns. Senator Coghill was unable to be here today as he is attending to other committee meeting. Is there any further committee discussion on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Machicki, can I have a motion to move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 4 from committee with the accompanying zero fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Without objection, the bill moves from the committee. We will continue as we sign the committee report. Next, I'd like to direct members' attention to CS for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill Number 12, Judiciary, an act relating to crime and criminal procedure, relating to assault, relating to credit towards a sentence of imprisonment for time spent in a treatment program or under electronic monitoring, and providing for an effective date. And I'd like to invite Senator Machicki and his staff, Edra Moorlidge, to present the bill. So when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Finance Committee. My name is Senator Peter Machicki, District O on the Kenai.
And for the record, Chair von Imhoff, my name is Edra Moorlidge, staff to Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is about a specific heinous crime that occurred on the 8th of August, 2017, when the perpetrator offered a ride to a young Alaska Native. She got into the vehicle. He took her a few blocks away. She got out of the car. He tackled her, choked her to unconsciousness, sexually assaulted her, and left her. The problem was that, of course, over a little more than a year, it became clear that our code was missing several key considerations on such crimes, and essentially he was convicted of, essentially assault. He was sentenced to 2 years. They gave him 1 year of electronic monitoring and suspended the second year. So that meant that someone that essentially nearly killed and sexually assaulted a young woman was released without spending any time in prison. And I just want you to think about that for a moment. For those of you like me, four daughters, a wife, many female friends, sisters, a mother, Senate Bill 12 resolves those issues. We've tried to keep it sort of encapsulating that type of crime because the public was, and most of us, were just so disturbed by the fact that that could occur today in this state, who's number one in the nation for sexual assaults, could just walk, right? So there are gaps in our laws that didn't come to light really until the Justin Schneider case. And that resulted in that plea deal, which fell far short in everyone's mind of what that individual deserved. He spent his year in electronic monitoring in a luxury home on Ketchikan Bay overlooking one of the most beautiful places on the planet with his family. So this bill gives prosecutors the tools they need to keep that from happening again, Madam Chair. It redefines what a sex crime is. It adds unwanted contact with semen. It requires registering as a sex offender for the offenses Justin Schneider committed. It increases penalties for strangulation in the commission of a sex crime. And it no longer allows credit for time spent on electronic monitoring for crimes against a person. And then finally, as you'll hear about this morning, it requires consultation, formal consultation on a plea agreement with the victim. And the reason for that is we feel that had consultation been required, it would have put additional focus on this case, that this case was different and should not have resulted in a plea deal where the individual walked without serving a moment of time in prison. So with that, Madam Chair, my staff is ready to give sectional if that is your desire.
I'd like to pause and see if the committee has any questions for the bill sponsor. Seeing no questions, yes. Please, Morledge, please begin with the sectional.
Okay, for the record again, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Machicki. Beginning on page 1, line 6, through page 2, line 5, this amends Alaska Statute 1141-200A, assault in the first degree, to add a new subsection 5, which is found on page 2. This adds a person who knowingly causes another to become unconscious by means of a dangerous instrument and defines dangerous instrument in accordance with the definition found in AS 1181-900. This is the strangulation to unconsciousness piece. Section 2 begins on page 2, lines 6 through 25. This adds knowingly causing a victim to come into contact with semen to the definition of sexual contact. Section 3, page 2, lines 26 through 28. This repeals and reenacts AS 1255-027-D to specify that a court may not grant credit against a sentence for time in a private residence or on electronic monitoring. Section 4, beginning on page 2, line 29, this amends AS 1255-027-E to remove electronic monitoring as an option for claiming credit towards a sentence of imprisonment. Section 5, beginning on page 3, line 8, going to page 4, line 4, this amends AS 1255-125C to add an enhanced sentencing structure for assault in the first degree when a dangerous instrument is used in the assault, which is a Class A felony. Section 6, beginning on page 4, lines 5 through 29, this adds an enhanced sentencing structure for assault in the second degree when a dangerous instrument is used, which is a Class B felony. Section 7 adds an enhanced sentencing structure for assault in the third degree when a dangerous instrument is used. This is a Class C felony. That's page 4, line 30 through page 5, line 23. Section 8 amends AS 1255-125-I to add increased presumptive ranges to second and third degree sex crimes when in the commission of the crime, a defendant possessed a firearm, used a dangerous instrument, or caused serious physical injury. This is page 5, line 24, through page 8, line 22. Section 9, beginning on page 8, lines 23 through 30, this adds AS 1261-015-D, a new subsection that requires the prosecuting attorney to make a reasonable effort to confer with the victim of a sexual felony or the person's legal guardian to ascertain if they agree with the proposed plea agreement. Section 10, page 8, line 31, repeals AS 1255-027-G, which allowed for sentencing for time spent on electronic monitoring. That's page 8, line 31. Section 11, page 9, lines 1 through 10, is the applicability clause. And section 15 is the effective date clause on page 9, line 11.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members regarding the sectional? Okay, we have three folks signed up for invited testimony. So I'd like to proceed with that. Our first invited testimony is Carmen Lowry, Executive Director of Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I believe Ms. Lowry is on the phone. She's here. I apologize. Okay, please come forward, actually. So when you're ready, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I would like to start by expressing my very sincere gratitude for the opportunity to talk about this bill and to also engage with you all about some of the serious nature of sexual crimes. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is a membership organization comprised of 24 community-based agencies that provide direct and life-saving services to victims and survivors. The network and all of our members fully support SB 12. We want to thank Senator Machicki for his leadership in addressing what were some very clear deficiencies in our laws. I want to talk about two particular areas. The first one is the section one, it's number 5, talking about the enhanced sentencing for assault and sex crimes where a dangerous instrument is used. As was earlier referenced, what this does is it expands the definition of strangulation. It allows for us to understand that it's more than just maybe using hands. That's how lots of people think about it. But what this does is it allows for us to understand that people use all kinds of things for strangulation, whether it's a forearm or it's a knee or it's a hip, that there's lots of different ways to stop someone's oxygen from going to their brain. The second one that I want to talk a little bit about is Section 9, and that's the one that calls for a reasonable attempt to be in contact with a victim if there's a plea deal and to talk with her. I want to just kind of reiterate how important it is for the prosecuting attorney to work closely with victim services agencies. More often than not, the shelter programs or the other victim service agency in a community has had contact with the victim. And so we would like to offer our expertise of working with the Department of Law, of working with whomever, to perhaps come up with a checklist, because we want to make sure that if there is statutory language that says a victim, there'll be a reasonable attempt, we want to ensure that that really is reasonable and that a victim doesn't feel like that they're just being consulted, but then their voice doesn't count. So it doesn't have to be as in written here that the prosecuting attorney, of course, is not bound in any way, but it would be really important to fully understand why a victim may have a certain perspective. And I'm also available for any questions if you have any for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lowry. I appreciate that. Is there any questions by committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lowry, thank you very much for coming in this morning. One of the questions as I read the bill has to do with Section 9. As you look at that section, you start seeing things that make it makes me see that there seems not to be the teeth in there that I would expect after what we've just gone through. You look at reasonable effort. I mean, sure, we can have a definition of reasonable effort, but still, that's such a almost a subjective type of attitude. And then it says nothing in the last sentence, nothing in this section or subsection requires or requires the prosecuting attorney to be bound by the victim's response regarding the plea deal. It just seems like it's another soft-handed Pillsbury Doughboy type of feel-good piece of legislation to the victim that's out there. What are your thoughts?
Through the chair, Senator, that is exactly one of the reasons we thought it might be helpful for there to be a checklist, for there to be an actual fillable form or whatever that says, here's all the different ways that you need to contact a victim. Here are some of the situations to be aware of, that there needs to be a bit more of a consultative kind of process. I will say, on the other hand, and it is a very somewhat of a catch-22, that sometimes a victim may not want to go on the record saying, yeah, I agree with this or I don't, because then that does seem to put some more pressure on her to be the one who determines what happens to someone who, more likely than not, is someone that they know. So I think that it's good to have that language in there. I think there has to be a process that would allow for the law to uphold the intent, which is to make sure that people are informed and are able to inform what occurs.
If I can continue, Madam Chair.
You get a follow-up question?
Yes. I guess that's, as we looked at that incident that happened and were aghast at what was there, we tried to analyze what the problem seems to have been. And one of the problems seems to have been that the prosecuting attorney, the criminal division essentially, that were trying to go for a conviction, almost acted recklessly in a rather arrogant way before and allowing the judge to go ahead and only have his hands tied to some of the sentencing that went on. So I guess that's what bothered many of us that were watching it from the sides. Mm-hmm. And that's why I thought we'd have more. We'd take it out of the hands of the prosecuting attorney, who I think, in my estimation, erred on the side of leniency and allowed the victim to suffer because of that. No further questions, Madam Chair. Just my comment. That's a rare Section 9.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Michiki has a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remember that the vast majority of what occurred on that day were not crimes in our previous code. So they essentially didn't have a case, unfortunately, other than the second degree assault. This piece was one of the last thing that we added to this bill, and it's because we felt, and you'll hear more from someone who's going to testify in just a moment, that was a major piece of this. But we tried to balance the point, Senator Olson, on not pushing victims to possibly participate in a level in which they were not comfortable. I mean, that's the problem with sexual assaults, is you're trying to get what you can on their participation, but every time they deal with this issue, they relive the incident time and time again. We tried to have a balance point that brought them into the fold formally without pushing them too far on the expectation. What we think this will result in is bringing the victim along to hopefully participate at a high enough level where we can prosecute individuals, such as in this case, to the highest extent of the law with their participation, something that doesn't exist at this level today.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Senator Wilson.
I just have a question. I did not know if the Department of Law would be testifying for invited testimony or available for questions later at a later time.
So the Department of Law is not on invited testimony, but we have someone standing in the back there that can answer your question. Or if you have a question, Senator Wilson.
I'll wait till Ms. Lowry is all done with her invited testimony.
Okay. Is there any other questions for Ms. Carmen Lowry? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Lowry.
Thank you.
So, Senator Wilson, do you have a question for the Department of Law? We do have two other people scheduled for invited testimony. One I don't see here, actually online. It's Ms. Kelly Olson, Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR. Is Ms. Kelly Olson here? Is she online? No. Okay. Before we begin our third, you can wait. Okay. Senator Marchicki, we have our third invited testimony, a testifier. If you would like to make a brief statement before that begins.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. The third testifier is Judge Michael Corey, and I've got to tell you that I was one of the ones that didn't support his retention. Unfortunately, he became the target of several missteps, in my view, that occurred. I think hindsight is always, well, it's not always 20/20, but it is for most reasonable people. And Judge Corey called me, and it was a surprise call, and I was glad that he did because he added that last piece. And I thought it was important that he helped sort of clarify why he thought the greater participation requirement by the victim was important. And I appreciate him calling me. I know this is uncomfortable for him, but I thought it would be valuable testimony for the committee to hear.
Okay, thank you, Senator Marchicki. So yes, our third invited testifier is Judge Michael Corey, who was the judge in the Justin Schneider case. So, Judge Corey, are you online? Can you hear us?
I sure can. Can you hear me okay?
We're going to turn you up right now. So, yes, could you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Corey, C-O-R-E-Y. And, yes, I was the judge who presided over the Justin Schneider case. I appreciate that folks, sometimes when you get titles, they kind of stick, but I want to make clear that I'm speaking on my own behalf as a private citizen, as I am no longer a judge. In my situation, I followed the law as it was, as I was required by my oath, and quite frankly, I was crucified for it. I support SB 12 because it's the right thing to do. Not only internally does it fix the problems that existed. Quite frankly, if the provisions of SB 12 had been in effect at the time Justin Schneider engaged in his actions, we would not have had all of the problems that have followed. I also wish, quite frankly, to be involved in this to help in some way my former colleagues that remain on the bench. I really would rather no one have to go through what myself and my family had to go through. It's pretty clear that there are segments of the population who exploit social media without any regard for accuracy or without any regard for who they hurt in the process of seeking some measure of political relevance. And it seems to me that if I was the problem back then, there'd be no need to change the law. Well, the answer to that is I was not the problem. The law was the problem. And quite frankly, SB 12 fixes that. And I've gone through the bill. I have a copy of it in front of me. And I certainly support, quite frankly, I support all of the measures that are included in there, not the least of which is the addition to the definition of sexual contact. Had that been included, the knowingly causing the victim to come into contact with semen, if that had been a portion of the definition of sexual contact prior to Justin Schneider's activities, there is no way that this plea bargain would have been sought by the prosecutor. Certainly Mr. Granick, anybody who knows Mr. Granick knows that he is not soft on crime. And had this law read this way back then, there is no way that this plea arrangement would have been suggested. If you move along, certainly one of the items that caused outrage was the credit for the time served on electronic monitoring. Again, my hands were tied. Mr. Schneider was entitled to that because of the way the law read, and it served essentially such that he would not have to return to jail. He was incarcerated initially, but I'm not sure how many days, but it was just a very few, and nobody would suggest that those few days of incarceration, in terms of a hard bed that folks refer to that sometimes, would have been sufficient consequence for the activities that he engaged in. I certainly have no trouble with the increase in the sentencing ranges. I would mention if I return to the definition of sexual contact, that would have made his offense a sexual offense and without any prior felonies, which he did not have. As I recall, he would have been presumptive, I believe, 2 to 12 years. And you can imagine that his sentence would have been much greater and would have had to register, I believe, for 15 years on the sex offender registry list. If you move, quite frankly, I know it's at the end, but in terms of addressing concerns of victims, really should be addressed up front. I know that the Alaska Constitution talks about, and it actually troubles me some, that we felt the need to point out that victims need to be treated with respect, because quite frankly, I think that should go without saying. But one of the things that we need to remember, and I think it's already been touched on during these proceedings, is that exhibiting respect for a victim obviously makes, it obviously allows them to participate in the proceedings if they wish. But I think that that respect should also be shown to individuals who don't wish to be in attendance at these proceedings. I think that victims should be permitted to heal in their own way, and that the views of a few, perhaps victims themselves, should not dictate how other victims have to conduct themselves. And so when the prosecutor says, well, we haven't been able to make contact or haven't, you know, made a call and they didn't return it, to the average person who doesn't sit there every day and listen to that, they think, well, my goodness, why the heck didn't they do more? And that may be the case. But the other possibility is that they can't find them because that person doesn't want to come forward. And if the defendant gets wind of that, the defendant says, you know what, maybe I won't change my plea. Maybe I'll go ahead and make these guys take me to trial. And maybe I'll make that victim get on the stand. And that's just something that is troubling, at least to me, all by itself. So the notion that myself or any other judicial officer doesn't take seriously respect for victims is either stated by somebody who has their own political aims or somebody who just doesn't understand how things work. If you turn directly to Section 9 and the amendment to AS 12.61.015, I like the fact that prosecutor has the affirmative obligation, because if memory serves, and I got to tell you, I didn't look this up before I joined you folks today, I believe that without this amendment, the obligation exists on the victim to come forward. And so I would tell you that at least a discreet, sensitive contact originating with the DA or the prosecuting attorney's office to these victims might sensitively bring more folks out and make sure that they know they're involved, et cetera. It does not create a relationship between the victim and the courts, and really nor should it, because the courts have to perpetuate their objectivity and individuality in these matters. I had thought, and I really appreciate Senator Michicki and Ms. Morledge taking my call here a few weeks back, and we talked about these concerns that we all have for the victims. And it seems to me that one possible way, and I know there are all kinds of unintended consequences, some intended, some unintended, when law gets changed, but one possibility would be to give a victim the veto power over a plea arrangement. And if a victim is willing to come to court, willing to engage at a level that they think that they're being wronged essentially by this plea bargain, perhaps they should be given an opportunity to veto the plea bargain going forward. At a minimum, if the language of the bill is going to stay as is and going to be enacted as is, when it talks about nothing in the subsection requires the victim to provide a response regarding the plea agreement, or requires the prosecuting attorney to be bound by the victim's response regarding the plea agreement, it seems to me that it would be helpful if the legislature would send the bench, meaning judicial officers, the freedom to reject the plea agreement because the victim does not agree. I think that needs to be in writing. I think that needs to be stated out there. You could put it I don't know if it would survive a constitutional challenge in placing it perhaps in AS 12.55.005, the codification of the Cheney criteria. But I can tell you what's going to happen right now. There's going to be this additional discussion about the victim's displeasure over a plea agreement, and the judge is going to wonder, do I have the authority to reject this plea agreement solely on the grounds that the victim disapproves? And there may be times when a plea agreement should be accepted, perhaps. Like, I'm willing to entertain that, even over the victim's objection. But it seems to me that I don't want to see my colleagues, or I should say my former colleagues, subjected to the same malicious attacks that me and my family experienced because folks are saying that the court disregarded the wishes of the victim. Because if you pass the bill the way it is, that's coming. And so I would simply say, unless you're going to expressly give the victim a veto over the plea, then you make sure that the court has expressly been told that it has the power to reject a plea because the victim disagrees with it. And I could talk for hours on this subject. I appreciate the time you've given me, and I'll answer now any questions anyone has.
Yes, we do have some questions, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The charge of kidnapping wasn't pursued in this case, and not being an attorney, I thought it was kind of odd, and I kind of understand that from reading the newspaper why. But should we be updating our kidnapping statutes to help in cases like this?
Well, I would say it never hurts to take another look. It's a little hard for me to answer that question specifically because I haven't reviewed it myself. I can tell you that the courts, cannot reject a plea agreement predicated on the manner in which the prosecution chooses to charge the defendant. So essentially, if they choose to drop that charge, that's essentially, it's a separation of powers issue between the executive and the judiciary. And so our hands are tied. So I can tell you that if there had been stronger law, perhaps Mr. Granick would have pursued that. But a lot of this has to do with what the prosecutor thinks they can prove. And, of course, the judges are precluded from involving themselves in that negotiation process. And since a plea agreement is, by definition, a liquidation of risk on both the state and the defendant's side, by definition, that plea agreement is either going to be too lenient or too harsh as compared to an eventuality that, of course, we'll never know because you can't run the play both ways. But that's a long-winded answer of saying, you bet. I can tell you that, you know, we talk about in terms, and I myself have sat up there in the past during sentencing. And, of course, in a plea bargain like this, it's either up or down. You either accept the whole thing or you don't. There are other parameters for other plea bargains, and certainly in open sentencing, one of the things that weighs upon a judicial officer is the question of community condemnation. And I got to tell you, there's been more than one time I've sat up there, and I've talked about community condemnation thinking, you've got to be kidding me. There is no way the community would think that this is adequate condemnation for the actions that are engaged in. And if anybody were to compare, in any plea bargain, if you were to compare the probable cause statement with the ultimate plea agreement, people would absolutely be horrified at the delta. People would constantly say, how in the world can you possibly let this person go with this sanction when they supposedly did all of these other things? So I'm sorry, I'm drifting away from the direct answer, but thank you for indulging.
Yes, we have Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Looking at the definition of kidnapping under the statute, AS 1141-300, a person commits the crime of kidnapping if a person restrains another with intent to, and there's a series of things, inflict physical injury upon or sexually assault the restrained person. There's another section, you commit the crime of kidnapping if the person restrains another under circumstances which expose the restrained person to a substantial risk of serious physical injury. The news reports that I have say that the woman was picked up at a gas station on Minnesota Drive by this guy and Schneider, and he said he was going to give her a ride to Muldoon. Instead of going east side, he went to Wisconsin and 36th, which is a different part of town, and then he tackled her to the ground, began choking her, threatened to kill her, told her he was going to kill her. This clearly meets the definition of kidnapping. So it also, I think, clearly meets the definition of attempted murder. So what would have happened if you rejected the plea agreement? What was the prosecution prepared to go forward on?
Well, they charged the kidnapping, and they charged, I believe it was assault in the second degree, and that's what they were prepared to go forward with. Now, whether or not they weren't going forward on attempted murder, and the judge does not have the power to direct the prosecution in terms of what charges they can bring. The judge has no power to stop them from dropping charges. So in terms of the activities that were alleged, it certainly has that reaction on many people, myself included. You know, here's the other thing that gets lost on folks. These fact patterns deeply affect the judicial officers. And I got to tell you, and I've had to do it more than once, when your own personal preferences and the letter of the law diverge, we are obligated to follow the law. And just because I follow the law doesn't mean I thought this was a good outcome. And quite frankly, now that I can speak freely, even before you get to what happened to me, if you're just talking about what happened to Justin Schneider and what happened particularly to his victim, absolutely, this is a horrible result. Horrible. Of course, I can't very well say that on the bench, now can I? I can't go in there and I can't try to throw the legislature under the bus saying, if only I had these laws, by golly, this would look different. That is beyond the scope of what a judicial officer does. But if you want to know the particulars about what the state knew, because they don't divulge all of that. I mean, the judge does not know, hasn't talked to the witnesses. There's no provision for any of that. So for me to know whether or not it's a good deal, essentially what judges are doing is they're telling you whether or not plea bargains are legal sentences. Because beyond that, the judge really doesn't know, quite frankly, particularly in these more narrow ranges. So without knowing not only what the witnesses are going to say, but how they're going to say it, and in this case, everybody talks about this particular victim and how, you know, people took up her cause. Well, you notice that she still hasn't come forward, and even the civil lawsuit that she brings as Jane Doe. Now I'd be the first person to tell you that those activities are within her rights and they should be respected. But what does that tell you about how anxious that individual was to take the stand and talk about activities in mixed company that she might never have considered? And that's before you get to cross-examination. So I think that if you want to know the particulars and you want to be critical of the charges that were pursued or you want to re-examine that, I think that requires a sit-down with the prosecutor's department, the DA's office, and specifically this prosecutor who cut the deal, and then talk to them about why they did what they did, because they're the ones that would be in a position to be able to answer that question more fully.
So I just thank you, Mr. Corey. Before we continue, I just want to remind that we do have other folks signed up to testify. I think it's important that we stay focused on the particular questions at hand and be concise and focus on the bill in front of us. Mr. Corey, you do have extensive knowledge on this particular bill, and we do appreciate you testifying today. But if we just want to keep our answers focused and on the questions, would be much appreciated. So, Senator Wilikowski, you have a follow-up?
I do. Just on the kidnapping charge, that's an unclassified felony, right?
Well, let me take a look.
1141-300C says kidnapping is an unclassified felony?
Yep, 0 to 99, yes.
That means potentially life in prison?
Yes, it would be 0 to 99 years. There would be some common law probably restrictions and ranges. You'd have to look at other cases to get the range. But, yes, it could be up to 99 years, yes.
And if I could, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
And there's case law that says that restraint, for the definition of kidnapping, can include moving to another location by deception, right?
I believe that's correct, yes.
So if you had rejected the plea, the case would have gone to trial on a kidnapping charge, right?
It would have, but the judges are not authorized to reject a plea because the state drops a charge. But yes, that is true. If there was a legitimate reason for me to have rejected the plea, which there was not, but had there been, it would have gone to trial, and the state may or may not have pursued kidnapping, depending on what they had. And the fact that Granick didn't, well, never mind, just leave it at that.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Corey, for your testimony today.
All right, thank you. Thank you, one and all.
So we now have, I can see two people signed up for public testimony, so I would like to open Senator Michicki.
Just before you do, I just want to make sure that everyone knows we chase down these trails. A conviction in kidnapping in this case would have been very challenging. Conviction of kidnapping is challenging anyway when it's clear cut where someone is taking to a place for an extended period of time. It's a difficult case compared to the tools we gave here. With DNA and with what occurred that day, what we've tried to do is put tools in place that would have resulted in a conviction on several counts that would have likely ended up with the same amount of time in prison that you're talking about with kidnapping. I just wanted to make that clear. It's not like we didn't chase down those, because that was my first. Why not attempted murder? Why not? Well, if you look at the presumptive ranges that we changed in this bill at this point, the crimes that have become crimes that weren't crimes before, you likely have the applicability that results in the same type of prison sentence that you would under kidnapping, only much easier to prove. So I just wanted to get that clear for the committee that it seems that a kidnapping conviction in that case, particularly without a willing witness or victim, would have been very difficult to prove.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. So I would like to open public testimony. We have Elizabeth Williams online. Ms. Williams, can you hear us?
Yes.
Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. You have about a couple minutes.
Elizabeth Williams, affiliated with No More Free Passes. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 12. I want to comment that Senate Bill 12 is different than any other crime bill this session. And that's because Senate Bill 12 recognizes that crimes of sexual assault, crimes of domestic violence, crimes that involve power and control are different than other crimes, and they need to be prosecuted differently. You know, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about criminal justice reform, talking about how the state can save money, how we can lower incarceration, and how we can make people healthier by providing treatment instead of incarceration. And I think there's a place for that. However, the goal of No More Free Passes is to educate policymakers that crimes of domestic violence, sexual assault, need to be treated differently. And I think Senate Bill 12 accomplishes just that. And I want to thank Senator Michicki for recognizing that and for offering a bill that really places crimes of power and control, especially when they are crimes against vulnerable people, are different and they need to be treated differently. Strangling another human being is one of the most dangerous things that you can ever do. It's one of the most terrifying experiences that a victim can experience. It's been compared to waterboarding because it's similar to torture. That feeling that you don't know where you're going to get your next breath is a trauma that can last with people for years, not to mention the lingering health effects that might not be seen immediately but will stay with the victim for the rest of his or her life. Crimes of sexual assault, as I'm sure you know, are very similar. They're very similar to torture in that they will stay with the victim for the rest of their life. They need to be treated differently. While other crimes, including nonviolent drug crimes or property crime, can be treated, perhaps with a second chance or, as the prosecutor in the Schneider case called it, a free pass. Crimes of sexual assault and domestic violence cannot be treated that way. The data shows that the recidivism, especially with domestic violence, is terrible. Within 1 year, 45% of domestic violence perpetrators commit another crime of domestic violence again. Within 7 years, about 75% of domestic violence perpetrators have committed another crime of domestic violence. And crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault are different because when you recidivate, you go back to your same victim. Unlike a car thief who will probably, once he gets out of jail, will probably not go back to the same car owner and steal his car. In crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault, they're almost always going to go back to their same victim. So when we have laws in place that put perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual assault back on the street within a year, or in the Justin Schneider case, with zero jail time, we are re-victimizing the same people over and over and over again. So again, I appreciate that Senate Bill 12 treats these types of crimes differently. They need to be dealt differently by policymakers with harsh sentences, probation, and restitution for the victim. I also want to speak to the provision that was added.
Ms. Williams, can you please wrap up your testimony, please?
Yep, to require prosecutors to confer with victims. It's the best standard that already should have been done, but this will formalize it and put it into law. So again, I thank all of you for listening.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. We have Marie McConnell from Sterling Online. Marie, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Marie McConnell, and I live in Sterling, Alaska. And I was calling about the part of SB 12 about not allowing credit for time on ankle monitoring. And so what I would like to communicate is that I think that credit should be given for the reduction in liberties and the fees that a person pays when they're on ankle monitoring when it comes time for the sentencing and the plea bargaining. And the reason why I feel that way is that ankle monitoring is a severe reduction in freedom and liberties. It is a form of punishment. It's like the adult version of being grounded as a kid. With costs, there's only a couple of private companies to choose from when a person is required by court to have an ankle monitor in the pretrial situation. So it's about $600 or more a month for the ankle monitor. So that's like $7,000 a year. And a lot of times people stay on pretrial for months to a year or two. So that's a huge fine that's being imposed by the state through the private company that has the ankle monitor. And I think that's a legitimate punishment to pay back society for the crimes once it comes to sentencing and plea bargaining. The other thing is that being on the ankle monitor isn't just an easy free pass. You have to plug it into the wall to charge the rechargeable battery in it, or you have to be sitting down next to an outlet for 2 to 4 hours a day charging that battery, because if it goes without charge, they're going to come find you and arrest you. The ankle monitor company is monitoring your every move, and if that has power or not. So you also, you can't leave the house except for approved activities, and you have to stay in a small area that company approves. So it's a pretty severe grounding of your liberties and where you can go. They have a curfew where you can't leave the house. You have to be in the house usually by 8 o'clock at night, and you can't leave until like 8 the next morning. So if there's like a sports event, a church thing that you were in, a volunteer opportunity, going to like borough meetings to testify, you can't be there because you have to start driving home in time to get home by 8. So you can miss out on stuff. So I know I'm getting close to 2. You can't wear boots. They'll cut into your ankle. So I just wanted to let people know, I think there's a public perception that it's an easy free pass. It's a severe penalty to wear an ankle monitor on pretrial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McConnell, for your testimony. Is there anyone else signed up online? Anyone in this room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. So Senate Bill 12 is before the committee for discussion. We do have the following people here in the room for questions. Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, Criminal Division, is here. Senator Wilson, would you like me to bring her to the table for questioning?
Yes, please.
Ms. Schroeder, could you please approach the table? So Senator Wilson, please ask your question, and then Ms. Schroeder, when you answer it, you'll state your name for the record. Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Schroeder. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you walk us through how Section 9 would work for a prosecuting attorney that may have had a strangulation case or a case similar to Snyder case, of how that would play a part? And then I have a follow-up question to that, Madam Chair.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, I'd be happy to do that. The language in Section 9 outlines best practice for a prosecutor as far as consulting with the victim. So it is not unlike what we already do for most cases. And that involves, at the case initiation, we contact the victim either by phone or email. If we can't get a hold of them that way, we will send out a letter. And in that initial contact, we will explain the rights that they have as far as appearing at arraignments or bail hearings. We tell them that we will consult with them before entering into a plea agreement. And we also outlined what might happen if the case goes to trial. And at that initial contact, we can usually get a sense from the victim about how involved they want to be. If they do want to be involved, then we will sign them up for what's called Vine Watch and Vine Link, which is an automated system that can notify them automatically every time a court hearing is set or changed, and then we'll automatically notify them if the offender is released from prison. When we get to the point where we think we might be entering into a plea agreement, we will contact the victim and run that agreement by them. And we will tell them what the law is so that they have a landscape of what the parameters that we're working within. And we will get feedback from the victim. And if the victim doesn't agree, we will make note of that. And we will often let the court know that the victim does not agree. We'll also tell them that they can show up at the change of plea hearing and express their dissatisfaction with the agreement.
Senator Wilson, follow up.
Yes. So I guess my deeper dive question is to how you would record the victim's agreement in the proposed agreement. Will that be on sort of a public record entered into that can be searchable? My concern is, in my years of working with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, is that the criminal process is just one piece of the puzzle, but then there's a civil case that may happen afterwards, and whether that agreement is recorded could potentially have a difference in their civil cases. So let's say they do agree with that, but it's a lesser deal to get them off. Does that play a part into their civil case, or how that, just basically how that is recorded into the record?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, we make a note in the file. So we have both a hard file and an electronic file, and we will make notes in both places. And that's so that any prosecutor who may be covering a hearing in the future can pick up that file and see immediately when we contacted the victim and what the victim had to say. So we make note of it in the file. At this time, we do not have a searchable database that even our own prosecutors internally can search. We would have to look up each individual case to see what each victim had to say. And it's not necessarily public. But if the victim is suing somebody civilly after the criminal case closes, we do work with civil attorneys often on that sort of thing. And that may be something that they could get via court order.
Senator Wilson?
So I guess my further question would be, you would go on the record basically and sort of stating, because when the state is prosecuting these cases, it's the state's case, not the victim's case. And sometimes there are, at that moment in time, may get labeled an uncooperative victim. I just don't want to see that harm them later when they may have the courage to say, okay, the criminal case is over, now I'm civil process for whatever reason, either child custody or for other situations that may occur to seek other damages. I just don't want that record to be entered to be negatively affect a victim when they may want to come forth later. That's my concern.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. I see Senator Machicki followed by Senator Wilikowski.
Just want to touch on that as she just stated. I'm sorry, I've got a complete blank. Work with her every day, but you heard the words often and sometimes, and generally this formalizes, so it's often on records in these such cases, this formalizes it so it's a requirement that it's recorded, which I think is kind of the gap. It gives a little extra, as the Department of Law testified in another hearing, as it does push them for a more formal process. So it's occurring. I'm not sure I can make a connection between a plea agreement and the change of a civil status. The crime still occurred. They still have the rights for the going the civil route afterward. This is just in the processing of the case itself for some sort of the best criminal conviction that's possible. But I just wanted to note that this formalizes a process that exists most often, usually, generally. It will be always in this case, and we felt that in the Schneider case, had that occurred, it might have given them the extra nudge to hopefully have that victim participate in a way that could have resulted in a much more significant conviction.
Ms. Schroeder, did you want to make a comment on that?
Just, Madam Chair, that Senator Machicki is correct. While I noted that this was best practices, the fact that it's going to be in law now, it is the law. So while it is currently the Department of Law's policy that this happened, this would actually be the law, and that's that extra incentive, that extra nudge that we need to be complying with the law.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. On Section 9, it says prosecuting attorney shall make a reasonable effort to confer with the victim of a sexual felony. Is there a liability or repercussions if an attempt is not made?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm not sure, other than not complying with the law, and as attorneys and officers of the court, we are required to comply with the law. I think that's the incentive there.
So it'd be, if I could, Madam Chair, potential bar penalties or something? Okay. A different question, if I could.
Senator Wilikowski.
So, was the state prepared to prosecute this case if a plea agreement was not rejected, and if so, on what grounds?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I was not the prosecutor in this case, and I have not done an audit of this case. If the plea agreement was rejected, I don't know what we would have been prepared to go forward with. That's something that it's hindsight is 20/20. I can talk to other people to try to get you an answer if that's what you want, if you would like.
Just follow up. Yeah, I'd be interested. This is a horrendous case. I don't understand why it wasn't prosecuted. It seems a clear definition of kidnapping. Quite frankly, it seems it clearly meets the definition of attempted murder. He told her he was going to kill her, and he began choking her. He tackled her, choked her to unconsciousness. So I just want to, I know we're trying to pass a new law to cover this, but it seems to me the laws cover this already. But I'm curious to hear from either you or someone in your department about why they settled for this very lenient plea agreement.
So if I'd like to interject, thank you, Senator Wilikowski, for this line of thinking, but I think that we are talking about this particular bill. And this particular bill has come out from this particular case, that is true. But in regards to asking why the case was not settled, I think is not relevant for this particular bill and what we're trying to accomplish now.
If I could, Madam Chair?
Sir, yes, Senator Wilikowski.
I'll just say this, and I think it is very relevant because if the current laws just weren't followed, then we really don't need to pass a new law. But if the current laws, and it seems to me like the current laws just weren't followed. That's my thinking, Madam Chair. So I'd really be interested in hearing, getting some response from the department as to why they didn't prosecute this, because it seems to me that the laws are very clear as they are, and they just weren't followed.
So, Ms. Schneider, if you wanted to get back with Senator Wilikowski on that particular case of why the particular laws were not followed at the time. We had talked about briefly about the kidnapping and whether that issue should also be brought up for future cases, if you want to wrap that into your discussion as well. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you look at, it was brought up about the case law, and then look at common law. The two of us have been to law school before. I would also like to I realize that we're trying to get a bill through, but I see the bill somewhat inadequate in what we're trying to go ahead and do. And Section 9 is particularly troubling to me, where the prosecuting attorney has the, and essentially the criminal division of our Department of Law has the unbridled, and is not bound, specifically unbound by the victim's response regarding the plea agreement. And so because of that, I would like to go ahead and have a report on that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. We have heard quite a few comments about Section 9, so I do urge the bill sponsor to get with the Department of Law to look at that section. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the previous comment from Senator Wilikowski, I just want to make sure that everyone understands that whether or not the iffy conviction on attempted murder or kidnapping may or may not have occurred, he still would have walked on it being a sex crime, because you couldn't have charged him with that because of the unwanted contact with semen. He still would have not been required to file as a sex offender. He still would have not been charged with strangulation in the commission of a sex crime. And he would have still gotten credit for time spent on electronic monitoring. So this change is required. It is required to adequately prosecute crimes such as the one that occurred with Justin Schneider.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Senator Schauer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Michicki, just so I know, the blank spots, bottom right of the chart you provided, is that because there's no changes to those under SB 12?
That, Madam
Chair. Is that the case?
Senator Michicki?
That is correct. These, that is correct.
Any further questions? Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, and I'm just to Senator Michicki, I would agree. I think that changes need to happen in the sex crime realm. I'm just at a loss as to why this wasn't fully prosecuted. But on the credits in Section 3, this has been something we've debated over the years. It seems to me that there's might be some merit to keeping some of the credits. Is that pretty standard in other states to have credits for time spent on electric monitoring? And historically, has the state allowed credits for that?
Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the language in Section 3 was what was in law for many years, prior to probably about 5 years ago. I think about 5 years ago, the legislature passed a law allowing for credit and electronic monitoring. And then in SB 91, some of that credit was capped at 360 days for some violent offenses, but otherwise it was uncapped, and the person could earn credit for the entire time that they were on electronic monitoring. So this is the fact that people are getting credit for electronic monitoring pretrial is a fairly new development in Alaska law. I have not looked at any other states. I don't know what other states do as far as that goes.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Time against credit for electronic monitoring has huge disparities upon who can afford it, who can't afford it. And, I would like to, if it is left in, I would like to see it capped or just taken out completely as the sponsor did. So I appreciate the sponsor for doing that, because it does lead to some inequities and disparities within who can, who can't have electronic monitoring.
Senator Michicki.
This will come up again. I think it'll come up on the other side, so I think it's important for folks to kind of realize what we did here. So think about the fact that offenders convicted of a crime received the benefit of pretrial time spent on electronic monitoring, but those found not guilty do not get that time back. So you're actually giving a benefit to a convicted felon that you did not give to an innocent person that was proven to be not guilty. And the reason I think, so that's just for pretrial, right? You can still use electronic monitoring post-conviction for someone who's the right candidate for electronic monitoring. But the reason the Schneider case, it was a problem, is they had an incentive to delay. They delayed six times until it was just over the one-year mark. So every delay that you make is less time that you spend in prison, right? So remember, the eventual sentence was 1 year on electronic monitoring because of the delays, and 1 year suspended for the second year that was associated with the assault conviction. But where we changed the law for electronic monitoring is only crimes against a person, essentially. And that's not, including but not limited to murder, manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, murder of an unborn child, assault, reckless endangerment, stalking, kidnapping, human trafficking, custodial interference, sexual offenses, domestic violence, sex crimes. So they are specific crimes. It still allows credit for electronic monitoring on minor crimes that are not against a person.
Thank you. I think what I'm hearing is that it's important to identify what factors contributed towards the unsatisfactory results in the Schneider case, and what do we need to do to avoid this kind of unsatisfactory result in future cases. And I think this bill is one step in that direction. And if there are other steps, then it's important that we continue to do their research. So. These kind of cases, we can avoid those unsatisfactory results. Senator Wilson.
I just have a question. Going forth, and Senator Machicki brought up a thing with sort of innocent folks getting off electronic monitoring or time served for another case. Do we still do banking of time for a similar crime? So let's say if I was accused of a crime, got let go, and then I was committed of a similar crime, I could use that time toward another sentence. Is that still allowed?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, not in the way you described. People can bank time if they're serving time on the same case, but if you are serving time on electronic monitoring, for example, and then you end up being acquitted or the case is dismissed, you cannot use that time that you've accrued to any other case.
Senator Wilson, follow up.
How about for a sort of a case globalization when we're trying to combine and try to do a global case settlement? Can then those other times be used for a case settlement in that case?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think as part of the global plea agreement, then they would address that in the plea agreement. They would say that the time he spent on electronic monitoring in this case, even though it's being dismissed, we would ask that it be applied to one of the other cases where he's pleading guilty, for example.
Senator Wilson?
About how many of those often have sort of a domestic violence, sexual assault, or strangulation type cases that end in those case sort of global resolutions?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, global resolutions are typically found when somebody's racked up a lot of cases and we want to dispose of them in one agreement. I can't say that they're not specific or are specific to any particular type of case. You usually see global resolutions when somebody has racked up a lot of cases.
Senator Wilson?
And I bring this up because during my time of going to court and testifying against batterers of doing that, they had a lot of other different charges that sometimes they would use to dismiss that case as well. So I did not know if that was part of the plea agreements in Senate Bill 12 to look at that you can't use those type of plea agreements in the globalization to get a lesser case as well.
Ms. Schneider, do you have a comment?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm not sure I tracked your last comment.
Is there anything in Senate Bill 12 to prohibit a globalization plea agreement that would offset sort of the recommendations and what we're trying to fix in Senate Bill 12?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, there is nothing that impacts how we negotiate cases in Senate Bill 12. Senate Bill 12 does not impact how we negotiate cases. It actually gives prosecutors more tools in the toolbox so that we have a little more flexibility in how cases may resolve. So, for example, the addition of the enhanced penalty for using a dangerous instrument in furtherance of a sexual assault in cases where we may be looking at strangling somebody to effectuate a sexual assault, we may be looking at the possibility of that those two charges merging, and so somebody would only be able to be punished once. So we would be seriously looking at that new language there in that case, where we would go after the sexual assault, also prove the dangerous instrument, and be a guaranteed enhanced penalty.
Senator Wilson, follow up.
So, I don't want to belabor this. I just feel that if someone, let's say, if Justice Snyder was on serving time or was on pretrial, off an ankle monitoring for assault, he served, you know, did the same thing a year, or some other heinous crime, and had sort of stacked up sort of cases and served a lot of time, he could have just sort of in the same time that he served could have been globalized to still have the same walk case if he was even charged with, let's say, a strangulation or a sexual assault crime. He still could have went off and had zero jail time if he served enough time, sort of had this time banked up in accrual.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I want to check on the transferring of time like that. That doesn't happen very often, so it's not something I'm that familiar with. So let me go back and check on that, and I'll get back to you.
Thank you. Does the committee have any further questions? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment, and I'm glad to hear Ms. Snyder say it on the record.
Schroeder.
Casey?
Yes.
Schroeder. It's my turn today. That the prosecutor will now have the tools in the toolbox, I think you said, to execute and do his job. So that's the best thing I've heard all day after this testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. We will be holding this bill for further review. So if there's questions that committee members want to get clarification on, they have the time and the freedom to do so. So at this point, Senator Marchicki, would you like to review the fiscal note, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, as I'm digging for the fiscal note, let me, if I can make one comment about what I think is another sort of secondary value of this bill. Right now, victims of sexual assault in the state of Alaska are not reporting. I believe 63% of sexual assault crimes are not reported, and part of it is because of outcomes like the Justin Snyder case. This hopefully will result in a lot more reporting, that victims, if they're going to go through the pain of a trial, they want to know that there's going to be an outcome where the perpetrator actually pays the price. And I just think this will be more helpful on them being more willing to engage, because it actually provides the tools for some results to hopefully protect other women in the future from that same perpetrator. So first fiscal note is fiscal note number one. It's Department of Administration, Office of Public Advocacy. The OMB component number is 43. It's indeterminate, Madam Chair. It will increase caseloads. The state will likely bring more cases, and these cases will require significant resources because of the severity of the charges and consequences of conviction. But of course, they don't know exactly what that caseload will be like at this point. The second is from the Department of Administration, Legal and Advocacy Services, Public Defender Agency, OMB component is 1631, also indeterminate for essentially the same number. They cannot predict the number of new cases that may be charged. The third is from Department of Health and Social Services, Juvenile Justice, Probation Services, OMB component 2134. That is a zero fiscal note, Madam Chair. Fiscal note number four is Department of Law, Criminal Division, Criminal Justice Litigation, OMB component number 2202. That is a zero fiscal note as well, Madam Chair. The fifth fiscal note is from Judiciary, Alaska Court System, Trial Courts, OMB component 768 is a zero fiscal note. The final, I believe, yes, is Department of Corrections, Population Management, Institution Director's Office, OMB component 1381. That has a 5.697 in FY20 million dollar fiscal note, which increases to 6713 in FY 2021, and then increases with escalation at that point. And that is the, I'm prepared. I was not prepared for this. And this is the additional days of incarceration at a $168.74 per inmate per day. This adds 10,950 incarceration days each year with a cost of $1.8 million per year and additional costs below, Madam Chair. This is also an assumption.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt real quickly. I have five fiscal notes. I do not have the sixth. Do any of the committee members have the sixth? Okay, we're going to do a quick at ease and see if we can locate the sixth one that you just determined, okay?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. This is Senator Von Imhoff back on the record. We are going to set this bill aside for further discussion. We have a fiscal bill that is not distributed out to the committee yet, so we're going to set this bill aside and pull it up at a later date when we have an updated fiscal bill. So that does conclude today's meeting. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We will have an overview of the capital budget and take public testimony. We may also take up SB 37, Renewal of Vaccine Assessment Program. We will let offices know as soon as the agenda is confirmed. We are adjourned.